All right, we're in Matthew, and we're in a very exciting section of Matthew. Matthew 5, 6, and 7 are what we call the Beatitudes, but they are more than just that. They are a way to live. Even though you live in this world, it's like you're living in another world. The modern phrase would be you're in two dimensions. And so the spiritual dimension versus the physical and the carnal. So when Jesus is teaching about certain things, he says, you naturally know, A, I knew these aren't going to work. I'm going to hope that I got a marker working. You naturally know, A, but I'm going to teach you about a higher way of living, a higher way of thinking, a better way. And so he's going to take us and get us to think about things differently than we would naturally. So naturally, I'll tell you, if somebody comes along and pokes me in the chest and looks like that, I want to poke them back naturally. That's just our carnal. That's A. And Jesus says, okay, that's what people do, even religiously. It's easy to have a religion where you teach what people already expect you to teach, what already comes naturally. So we're trying to live in what's called the kingdom world, the kingdom of God especially, okay? And so when we get into 5, 6, and 7, he just takes people from this level up to here, constantly pushing. And it is, I'll tell you this, as hard as it was to live under the law, because the law governed our natural tendencies. It governed, don't do this, don't do that. That was God governing what we did naturally. But Jesus is trying to get us to live under a separate set of laws that actually governed us spiritually, that governed our hearts and governed the way we reacted. And that's why it's so beautiful. It actually is one of the most amazing portions of the gospel. So we're on number 7. What page is that in your handouts?
37.
Actually, good.
We're actually number 6.
Oh, yeah, teaching on divorce,
yep.
Is our next one. Good. It's my 7, so that's my fault. Number 6, teaching on, and you fill in, is divorce. And we're in Matthew chapter 5 and verse 31. So let's read 31 and 32, two very short verses, but a very big topic. Verse 31 says, it hath been said, whosoever shall put away his wife. And you understand the words put away is another phrase for divorce. Whosoever shall put away his wife, let him give her a writing of divorcement. Just make sure it's legal. But I say unto you, that whosoever shall put away his wife, saving for the cause of fornication, causes her to commit adultery. And whosoever shall marry her that is divorced, committeth adultery. Now, if this was the only portion of Scripture that talked about divorce, we'd be in trouble, because there's more to marriage, divorce, and remarriage than just this. And so a lot of people just go, see, if you've ever been divorced and you remarry, you're an adulteress. That's kind of cruel, okay? If that's all we ever had, they would be right. But that's not all we have. There is, in Matthew chapter 19, Jesus expands on that. So let's talk about the teaching on divorce. That's a very brief description, and it's not all-inclusive. But I want you to know, let's go back to Deuteronomy 24. Deuteronomy 24, where Jesus is referring to them and saying, you heard it said of old, give, if you're going to divorce somebody, make sure you do it legally. That's what he's meaning by give them a writing of divorcement. So, Deuteronomy chapter 24, verse 1. When a man hath taken a wife and married her, and it come to pass that she find no favor in his eyes, there's no love, because he hath found some uncleanness in her, maybe there's a fault with her, maybe she can't have children, maybe she can't cook, but usually those are the examples. But when it says uncleanness, it means that there's just no health in the relationship. Maybe they're fighting all the time. Uncleanness is a big picture. It usually meant unhealthy. If you said something was unclean, it was because they were diseased. So say you marry somebody and she can't have children or whatever may be going through. to the husband, he says, she's not what I expected. Then let him write her a bill of divorcement, securing that, okay, this girl's not just being used. They actually officially got married, and now he's officially divorcing. It's a public thing. It's not a secret thing, not just getting rid of somebody. And give it to her hand and send her out of his house. Sounds very cruel, but it actually was for a reason. We'll talk about it in a minute. And when she is departed out of his house, she may go and be another man's wife. She's not bound up to that first husband. And if the latter husband hate her and write her a bill of divorcement and giveth it her hand, right? Now again, God, through Moses, is having him write out possibilities. And okay, so she's not loved by the second husband, not wanted by the second husband, and send her out of his house. Or if the latter husband die, which took her to be his wife, her first husband, her former husband, which sent her away, may not take her again to be his wife. After that, she is defiled. Now, I want you to circle that word defiled, because divorce does hurt people. Divorce defiles your heart. When you've gotten into a marriage and you've had to break it up, it's hard to recover. But anyway, after she's been defiled, meaning she's been with another man, you don't bring her back into the first husband's home. For that is abomination before the Lord, and thou shalt not cause the land to sin, which the Lord thy God giveth thee for an inheritance. So, Old Testament instructions on divorce are found here in Deuteronomy 24. Look what Moses allowed men and women to divorce over. Generally, a loss of love, discovering something unclean or unhealthy or a defilement. Say if you find out your wife that you thought was a virgin, you find out she wasn't a virgin. Do we have anybody in the Bible that did occur to? Where somebody was getting ready to get married and they found out they were not a virgin. No, he went out and found a woman who already was in a harlot.
Oh, my God.
Mary and Joseph.
Oh, yeah.
All of a sudden you find out you're not a virgin. And so he quietly puts her away. For all practical purposes, they were married. They just had not consummated it, had not had the ceremony. And so he, for all practical purposes, he gives her, he's preparing to put her away. So now what Moses required of the two people was to write this woman, and it works the other way around, but write her an official bill of freedom from the bond of marriage. Now, like I say, it could be the other way around. Could be the husband being given a bill of divorcement, even if the other person doesn't want a divorce. And that's very important. You allowed the divorce to be forced. Here, Moses is not saying you guys should argue this out. One woman should hold her ground and not allow for divorce. He says, no. If one person doesn't want to be married, he can give a bill of divorcement. Roman numeral 3, send her away. This is what the requirement that from owning you anything. You're now free. There's no responsibility back on the relationship, making them free. And she and the other person can marry anyone now and not be seen as bound to the previous marriage. The only stipulation is that once one of them has remarried or been defiled by another spouse, they cannot go back together with their previous mate. It protected physical abuse. So if somebody's forced to be married to someone they no longer wanted to be married to. So can you imagine if you especially, we're dealing with Old Testament scenarios, we're dealing with farming people who would be widespread, and people would be alone, living miles maybe from anybody, and they're in an unhappy relationship, and somebody says, I find no joy in this marriage, whatever. Well, what did Jesus say Moses put that in there for?
The hardness of their hearts.
Yes. And so when you have two people and you force them to be together, and one of them doesn't want to be there, what's going to happen to the other person? Abuse. So this protected from abuse, allowing, let them, if they want to walk away from the relationship, let them go, because otherwise it is going to turn into abuse. Second thing, it protects from an adulterous husband who would, for a fling, divorce his wife, so that he could be with another woman, and then go back and remarry his wife. And you can't. And it's protecting so that you can't, you know, just have these legal acts of harlotry. So, I want you to notice that divorce does defile. I don't believe divorce is ever a blessing. It may be necessary, but it is never a blessing. So, the idea is, whosoever shall put away his wife, let him just give her a writing of divorcement. So, Jesus says, everybody knows that at level A, at the norm here, divorce for any reason. That was how they talked. Now, I don't believe divorce was very widespread. That was not the issue. The issue is that people could get a divorce, and people had this idea of, okay, well, if things don't work out, you can seek a divorce. But Jesus pushes everybody up to another level, like, oh, level B, it doesn't matter. And he says, but I say unto you, going back to Matthew, verse 31, 32, but I say unto you that whosoever shall put away his wife, saving for the cause of fornication. So, Darren, who's the instigator of the desire to divorce?
In this case. It's talking about putting away your wife, so it would be the husband.
Okay. So here's the husband who says, I no longer am in love with my wife. I no longer think my wife is worthy of me. I think my wife is maybe she's unhealthy. Maybe she can't have a child. Maybe all she, like, remember King Henry VIII, my wife can't give me a son. All of these things. Well, Jesus says, you know what? And this is the big deal. This is the thing. Jesus, I'm going to draw you a chart in a moment. I need you to help me complete the chart. But when he says about divorce, he says a divorce for any reason is not good enough. It is not good enough. I'm looking for this. Okay. I am missing my statement here. But anyway, okay. So when he says, no, in the kingdom of God, the idea is you must have, a very serious reason. What was the reason, Edward? What was the reason that Jesus said was permissible for a man to seek a divorce from his wife?
Fornication or adultery.
Okay. So he's very specific with the word fornication. I know sometimes we think of only adultery, but let me tell you, fornication is a wider meaning of a word. So he's very restrictive. The only time you should divorce your wife is for the cause of fornication. So let's look at fornication. Now, let's see. Allison, my brain went dead there for a second. Allison, what does adultery mean?
Adultery, it's where you break the marriage oath, where either the husband or the wife would have sex with another partner.
Okay.
Outside of the marriage.
Yeah. And they're seeking a marriage privilege, mm-hmm. not within the marriage, but to somebody else. And that is adultery. And it is serious. But Jesus doesn't say for the sake of fornication, sort of for the sake of adultery. No, he's a little bit wider. And this is where fornication. Fornication is any sex that is not between a husband and his wife. And that is more general than adultery. Any kind of sex outside of marriage, either before and during marriage. Remember, Joseph and Mary hadn't had any sex, and yet the idea was she had had sex before, that's what he thought, before their marriage, and that was considered fornication. So he's like, well, that I can't marry a woman who's not going to be faithful to me. That was in his mind. But I want you to understand this. Go to Jude chapter 1. There's only one chapter. Jude chapter 1. Verse Jude chapter 1 and verse 7. And here's the judgment of God. Now, I want you to see the use of the word here, because there are seven uses of this word fornication that give you a bigger view than just premarital sex, but it's actually any sex either in or before marriage. Verse 7 says, even as Sodom and Gomorrah, what kind of sex was that they had?
Oh, it was filth.
It was filth. It was homosexual. So even as Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities about them, in like manner, they gave themselves over to what? What's the word? So they were addicted not to sex between men and women, but to men and men and women and women. So the word fornication is more than just what most people think is fornication is sex before marriage, adultery is wrong sex after marriage. No, no, no. Fornication is wrong sex outside of marriage, whether you're married or not.
So here it was immorality and perversion?
Yes. So even if you're married and you find out your husband is homosexual, or and he's with other people, or let me go even further, because in the Old Testament it got very, very graphic. What if you find out I hate saying it, but into bestiality? Or let's just be very plain, somebody's addicted to pornography. Now let's pretend we're under the Old Testament. Somebody is very lustful and is just, they I don't even like describing it. They're into drawing pictures back then. Should a wife, under the Old Testament, should a wife be allowed, or not be allowed, be forced to live with a man who is a pervert? Under the Old Testament, no. That's why the word. So Jesus says, all right, even under the New Testament, if you're married and this guy is a pervert, now Jesus is just saying, basic thing saying, that's the only time. That's a serious reason. Then divorce is allowed. And I don't think that a woman should say, I just found pornography under my husband's couch or whatever. I'm divorcing him. That would be stupid. You need to try and reconcile. But if he doesn't want to change, can you imagine living in that type of scenario? Jesus is not creating a bondage that is unbelievable for her to have to deal with. So I list three of the seven: homosexuality, bestiality, pornography, are what Jesus is allowing for as a reason for divorce. Now, the abandoning of your wife is actually causing your wife to commit adultery. Did you notice that? So he says in verse 32, he says, I say unto you that whosoever shall put away his wife, except for the cause of fornication, you're abandoning your wife and you're causing her to commit what? Adultery. And whosoever marry her that is divorced committeth adultery. Now this is actually quite important, because and we could take a long time. I don't want to try to dissect. I just want you to think, when you're reading these verses, these are deep and they're to be pondered. These will change the way you look at marriage, the way you look at divorce. And so when you're married to somebody and you're happy and you love the other person, but the other person doesn't love you, doesn't want to be around you, finds fault in you, wants to divorce you, and you're happy being married, and they dump you, they throw you out of the house, how do you think you're going to feel? We call it abandonment. That person, especially a woman, if she's now out of the house, now we're not dealing with kids, we're dealing with just thrown out of the house, not with a family, and you've thrown somebody out of the house, she now has to fall in love with somebody else that she's violating her vows in her own heart. It's called violating conscience. And you're causing her to commit adultery because she wanted to stay in the marriage. So this is more than just, my mom has been married and divorced, but her, my dad left her. It was abandonment. And so when my mom wanted to remarry, you know what she was afraid of? If I ever do remarry, I guess I'm an adulteress. And I went, no, Mom, not at all, okay? It's going to be hard for you because you loved Dad and you tried to make things work. And you got to decide on whether you can move on. But generally, you are causing, my dad caused my mom to have to violate her conscience to go and seek a new man. That's the point. Can adultery be forgiven, yes or no? Of course it can. But this is the level where Jesus is raising a marriage to where marriage is not for throwing away just because somebody is unhappy. So Paul deals with Jesus deals more with marriage in Matthew 19 and also Mark chapter 10 and brings in a lot of extra things, which we'll just skip for a minute. But Paul even deals with remarriage in 1 Corinthians 7, and he says, when you've been abandoned, especially by an unsaved person, he's dealing with Gentiles now, and a Gentile spouse leaves, well, he calls it, he says, could that person even be saved? Because if the unbelieving depart, what should you do? Let him depart. All right, go to 1 Corinthians chapter 7, just to settle this. 1 Corinthians chapter 7. And verse 27. Art thou bound unto a wife? Seek not to be loosed. All right, that's pretty general. If you're married, don't seek divorce. Art thou loosed from a wife? If you've been divorced, seek not a wife. Generally, if it hasn't worked, then just stay single. But, and if thou marry, talking to the person who's lost their marriage before, thou hast not what? Wow. Paul makes a very bold statement that some people don't find it easy to say. Well, if you've remarried, you must have sinned. No. And if a virgin marries somebody who's divorced, that's old context, she hath not sinned. Nevertheless, a divorced person and a never divorced person, such shall have trouble in the flesh, but I spare you. He's trying to spare him, saying, don't remarry. And I'm trying to save you from that, but you've not sinned. So even Paul deals with remarriage and just saying, don't be so judgmental of yourself or of others. So there's some big questions here. Number one, where does divorce begin? Now, I give you the answer there. But in each one of these things here, at the first level, at the general natural level, everything here is the flesh. Okay? It's what we call natural law. All right? Now, under this, we're dealing with the heart. And what is the difference in the heart, Darren, after you've been born again versus the heart before you're born again?
Before you're born again, you're dead. Mm-hmm. Your spirit's dead, and so you're not seeking God's way of doing things.
That's right. And your heart is only reacting like it always does. But when you're born again, you have a new heart, don't you? And so whatever you're going through in the flesh, whatever you're going through naturally, Jesus says, I want you to live by the new heart, not by the old heart, not by the old man. So divorce always begins in the heart. Where is marriage defined? It is not defined in Deuteronomy 24. Marriage is defined in Genesis chapter 2. Let's go to Genesis chapter 2. That's why in Matthew chapter 19, Jesus actually says, guys, didn't you ever read where a man shall leave his father and mother? All right, so this is where marriage is defined. People who are pro-divorce, they always run to Deuteronomy 24. Well, I hate divorce. I know Deuteronomy 24 makes an allowance. Even Matthew chapter 5 makes an allowance. But marriage is defined in Genesis chapter 2, verse 24. And it's right here. This says, therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother, and shall cling, stick unto his wife, hold on to her, and they shall be one flesh. And somebody once gave the illustration of, if you ever take two pieces of paper and glue them together, how easy will it be to pull them apart? If you ever pull it apart, you're left with shreds. It's never like it was before you put them together. And that's divorce. It may be necessary. It may be something that is a last ditch. But in Christianity, it must be serious. And you know, guess where we're at today? Men are wicked. Women are wicked. If there's anything that is under attack, it is marriage and the concept of keeping it pure and keeping it clean. All right. So what is the cause of fornication? Well, I write in here, it is the same as the causes of adultery. Adultery is you're unsatisfied. Fornication is, whether it's pornography, whether it's homosexuality, anything along in there is a lust of the flesh. And it is that person who is struggling with fornication, they usually need to be born again. Now, can Christians struggle with fornication? Can Christians struggle with adultery?
Yeah.
Give me an example, somebody in the Bible who struggled with adultery.
David.
David. Anybody else? Now I'm going to push it a little bit further.
Was it Solomon?
I would say Solomon struggled with it.
Yeah.
And instead of him actually going as far as committing adultery, he said, well, I'll marry her. I mean, it's when you get down to it, you start thinking, Solomon was wicked, man. He just made it legal. So, all right. Any questions on that? Because usually it's a hard subject to deal with. Yes, sir, Dr. Edward.
Yeah, like the sons of Judah, what would you say their situation is regarding this matter?
Which matter?
The one that was first married to Tamar.
Tamar and Judah? It's adultery. Judah committed adultery. He married a woman who was waiting for his son. Now, I don't know if he actually, what does he call Tamar? He says, where is the harlot that was here? So that's why it's called, I call it adultery, but let me just be real plain. It's actually fornication because I can't tell whether Judah was still married at that time. Judah's wife may not have been alive. So it's actually, I can be sure knowing it's fornication because he's seeking, I hate being so crash, he's seeking sex from a woman he does not intend to marry or to be married to. So it's fornication. She's a harlot. He may be married. And if he is at that time, it is adultery. But I'm not told whether his wife was alive at that moment. So at least it's fornication. And it was, and listen, Judah should have forfeited his line of having anything to do with the Messiah. But because Judah humbled himself and said that his daughter-in-law was more righteous than he, and yet she was wicked, he humbled himself. He fell into the crack of grace. He happened to go into a place where he got right with God, and God had grace with an evil man, and went ahead and gave Judah the Messiah, only because of humility. So, okay, does that answer your question? Okay. Anybody else? Now, we move on to swearing is your next for verse 33. Swearing. Let me see if I can draw you a chart here, and I want you to start to fill in this chart maybe on another page. Oh, no, that's not enough. Let me do it this way. Okay, so now, in this chart, I want you, let's go back to, in verse 21, what are the, back in Matthew 5. Okay, so I'm going to say 5:21, and the first thing we're going to say is, thou shalt not kill. Okay? Now, this was Old Testament law, and I say Old Testament law plus. Why would I say plus, Darren? Not just prophets, but it was tradition. They were adding stuff. Now, yes, the Bible says, thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not kill. But he said, you know, extra, Jesus says, you guys keep making up stuff from the Old Testament, and you're not pondering what even any of the words mean. So he says, thou shalt not kill. Jesus calls us, pushes us further than just what the Old Testament said. So when he said, thou shalt not kill, in verse 21, anybody see what you read down there and give me his response. What does he say is the emphasis that we ought to pick up as believers in the kingdom of God? No, that's not on 21?
Yeah, 21.
21, okay. I got a different thing now, sir. Thou shalt not kill. Who shall kill be endangered? I say unto you that whosoever is angry, agreed, don't be angry. That would be very safe. But I'm going to take you, I'm not going to say you're wrong, but I'm going to say verse 23, therefore, if thou bring thy gift to the altar, and there rememberest thy brother hath aught against thee, leave there and before the altar and go thy way and be what? All right, so the law said, do not kill. Worry about the desire to murder. But instead of, all right, so we, you know, let's just write this thing, the desire to murder. But Jesus said, worry about the desire to reconcile. You can't be angry and stay angry anymore. You have to reconcile. So now, after that, the second one, verse 27, in 5:27, you have, thou shalt not commit adultery. And Jesus says, no, what you need to worry about is what? What's the problem with adultery? Where does adultery begin?
In the heart, lust.
Lust. So worry about lust. Isn't that more important than worrying about the physical act? Okay, so you see where Jesus is pushing Christianity into a whole nother realm of thinking and living. So verse 33, let's get to 33, because he talks about, 5:33, he talks about forswearing. All right, so let's look at verse 33 now. Again, ye have heard that it has been said by them of old time, sometimes they can quote the Old Testament, sometimes they kind of twist it, thou shalt not forswear thyself, but shalt perform unto the Lord thine oaths, meaning keep your oaths, keep your vows. But I say unto you, swear not at all, neither by heaven, for it is God's throne, nor by the earth, for it is his footstool, neither by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. Neither shalt thou swear by thy head, because thou canst not make one hair white or black. But let your communication be what? Yes or no?
Yes,
yea, or nay, nay. But whatsoever is more than these cometh of what? Yeah. All right, so if somebody's trying to, I don't, you know, like a politician, you try to get a clear answer out of them, and they're like, because there's something going on in the background. So when we come to forswearing, what is it that Jesus says we should focus on?
Instead of worrying about breaking the oath, don't make the oath in the first place, because you can't foretell the future.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, there are times where you do make an oath, like when you're marrying, and you're making a promise, that is, till death do you part. But here he says, be yes or no. It's one or the other. You can't play both. So Jesus just says, because in the old days, in Jesus' day, guess what the people were used to doing, because they didn't trust anybody. So what was everybody doing in Jesus' day? When they made a promise, they said, I swear. Oh, I swear. And this is what, when we were kids, we'd say, I swear on my mother's grave. We didn't know what we were saying, but we heard it on TV, you know? And oh, I swear. It's a stupid way to talk, because it means nothing. So Jesus says, your yes needs to be yes, or your no needs to be no. And that is character, isn't it? What a way. back in the mid-1800s in America, I don't know about here, and it may have been true because the Methodists were a different kettle of fish back then. But if you went in to get a mortgage on a house, and they would look at you and they go, how do we know you're going to pay this back? If they found out you were a member of the Methodist denomination, Methodist Church, they gave you the mortgage on the spot. Because, yes, that was only for about 30 or 40 years where that happened. But there was such a different way of living. The Methodists lived by a higher code, and if they made a promise, they kept it. And I wish that was true, that Christians were like that, because when people meet Christians, they ought to know, I can trust that person. When that person says yes, they mean yes. And when they say they can't do it, don't push them. They can't do it. I'll go and get somebody else. Yes or no. So this is it. Forswearing means swearing over and over and over and over. Just don't do it. Let's move on to the next one. Verse 38. Ye have heard that it hath been said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Now that's good justice, but it's not good personal justice. I say unto you that ye resist not evil, but whosoever shall smite thee on thy right cheek, turn unto him the other also. And if any man sue thee at the law, and if he wins and he takes away your coat, let him have thy cloak also. And whosoever shall compel thee to go a mile, go with him twain. Give to him that asketh thee, and from him that would borrow of thee, turn not away. So in verse 38, what is it that they were living by currently? What was it?
Retaliation.
Okay, I like that. Retaliation, I like that. Okay, I have revenge, but they were constantly retaliating or seeking revenge. Somebody hurts you, take them to court, you know? Seeking revenge. And what does Jesus say? What is his way? Now, yes, did they have the right to go to law according to the Old Testament law? Yes. That's one of the great things about the Old Testament law was it gave a procedure of how to deal with people who commit a crime against you. And we're talking about personally as well. But if you apply eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth with everyone you deal with, what is the normal phrase? Most everybody will be either with one eye or toothless. Okay, so Jesus moves to a new realm or to another level. What is the new level?
Forgiveness.
Okay, it is forgiveness, but it's more than that. Did you know this is actually only half of the work that forgiveness offers, and that is go the second mile with those that have hurt you. And that is revolutionary. You just can you imagine his disciples and everybody listening to him how that must have hurt them, because the Romans already were abusing, and a Roman soldier come along and says, here, carry my bag a mile, and Jesus is saying, take it too. Now, what good was that, Darren? What could possibly be good about that requirement on Christians?
Well, a couple things. One is a testimony.
Excellent.
The other thing is also a humility. You know, you're not being self-centered.
Wow. Is that easy? Are either of those easy?
Well, it depends on what you mean by easy. But no, in the wood flesh, it's impossible.
Very good.
But, you know, if you look at the things from God's perspective,
they're better.
It's a very minor thing.
I agree. All right, my flesh will always scream when I have to humble myself. My flesh will never want to do what Christ says. But if I'm under the dominion of the Spirit and under the dominion of God, I ignore my flesh and I do right and I end up better. And also our world, as you said, our testimony, the world around us is better off because one godly Christian light can illuminate a lot of darkness. So when you have one who, when they are offended and when they are abused and when they are rejected and when they are martyred and they stand true and they stay sweet and they glorify God and they love their enemies, the world goes, what did we just do? So it is, again, this new way of living is called kingdom living. It is how Jesus says, this is how you live in my kingdom. Let's go to number 9.
Just for the fill-ins.
Oh, what are my fill-ins?
Paying back blank for blank.
Yes, I'm not there. Teaching. He's teaching on not always paying back evil for evil. I forgot about that. Thank you.
And the other fill-in.
And the next one is Jesus is actually teaching biblical pacifism. But I use the word biblical in front of that because a lot of people want to be pacifists, but they're not biblical pacifists. Let me quickly say, biblical pacifism is turning the other cheek, but it is not that we should allow others to murder or rape or smash things while we stand passively by. A true pacifist doesn't get involved in anybody, and that's not right. But when somebody hurts us, we let them. That is where, like as you talked about, in the flesh, an unsaved person is not going to be able to do this. One of the ways you know you're saved is that your flesh says, I can't do this, but there's a voice inside that says, but I've got to. Because there's another conscience inside of you. It's the Spirit, Holy Spirit of God. Now, there is a limit.
If you're living this and where, then when something happens and the flesh takes over, like something happened to me in work, and I turned around and said to one of the girls, because I try to always live this way, with God's help, and I turned around and said to one of the girls, I was ready to thump her there. I really was. I need to calm down.
Yeah.
I need to take 5 minutes out of the room. And she passed it on to the nurse. And the nurse for a while tried to keep us out of each other's way. And she says, you know, when that girl told me you said that, she says, I was shocked. And I thought something had to be seriously wrong because it's not like you at all. So I was sorry that it happened, but it proved to me they can see.
Oh my goodness, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, they can. Mm. That's why Jesus said, let your light so shine before men. This is how our light shines. Our light is shine, and there's like 15 things here that we're going through in 5, 6, and 7. So pacifism, there's a limit. When a person attempts to hurt us enough to put us into the hospital, that's when you got to stop them. And that's why I taught all our kids. We had them in Taekwondo. I taught my kids, look, somebody comes along to my son Joel and pushes him. He just keeps walking. But if somebody pulls out a knife and tries to stab him, it's time for him to grab their hand, throw the knife away, and kick them hard and then run. Because a true pacifist doesn't fight at all. But a biblical pacifist says, this guy will kill me. And that is wrong. And it could stop me from being a dad. It would stop me from being my dad's son. So especially if they're going to physically maim me or whatever, I can stop them and get away without actually turning the knife on them. That would be justice, but that's not what we're doing. So when somebody says something against us, we let them. When somebody robs us, we let them. But when somebody's robbing someone else, we intervene. It would be stupid. And I told my kids this. I said, if somebody comes along and says, give me your wallet, guess what you do? Give me your wallet. if it's just one guy, and if you can sense, like, normally these people who tries to mug you or steal from you, normally they have prepared for the fact you're going to fight. So if you try, you're going to end up hurt. Just give me your wallet. Okay? Now, again, there are extremes, but you don't fight. But when someone's robbing someone else, guess what we do? If I see somebody being robbed, I intervene. The idea is that we do not seek revenge for ourselves, but we yield our rights and our demands as Christians, knowing that God granted those rights to us and can, on a whim, God can suspend them. So if I have the right to be respected, do I have that right? Of course I do. But if somebody doesn't respect me, evidently God has suspended that right at that moment, and I'm to be humble. As Darren said, it's a time for me to be humble. I have the right for somebody to speak to me respectfully, correct? That is right. You speak to me right. But if they don't, God has suspended that right. He gave me the right, and he can say, no, right now I'm taking that right away. Let's see how you handle when you're under pressure. And that's a big deal. No longer do I worry about what the person's doing to me. I worry about what a God, what are you trying to teach me? And I yield to it, and I yield my cloak, or I turn the other cheek, and I stop demanding my rights, and I let the Spirit of Christ be more important to me than the spirit of the flesh. All right. Let's see. I also make a point here. If you don't do that, you're going to become hateful, angry, bitter, and vengeful. And you will, if you're not careful, if you don't humble yourself, you'll become a tool of Satan and not a tool of justice that you think we are. Another point is, that doesn't mean that you don't point out somebody's injustice. So if somebody's rude to you, say your boss is talking to you really rudely, everybody else he's nice to, but to you he just tears you down every time she sees you, it would be right for you to take the boss aside and say, I have to tell you, your words hurt. There's nothing wrong with that. You're not supposed to just be a doormat. Any woman who has a husband that is abusive to her needs to be able to say, that is wrong what you're saying to me. That is wrong what you're doing to me. And yet she says it out of love. So, number nine for you. Teaching on conquering your enemies. Let's look at verse 43. You have heard that it hath been said, thou shalt love thy neighbor and hate thine enemy. But I say unto you, love your enemies. Bless them that curse you. Do good to them that hate you. And pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you, that ye may be the children of your Father, which is in heaven. For he maketh the sun to rise on the evil and on the good, and sendeth rain on the just and on the unjust. For if you love them which love you, what reward have ye? Do not even the publicans the same? And if ye salute your brethren only, what do ye more than others? That's the challenge. Do not even the publicans so? Be ye therefore what?
Perfect.
Even as your Father which is in heaven is perfect. So Old Testament, those laws, Jesus is pushing them to what he calls perfection. This is perfect living. Do you think that means that they didn't sin?
No.
But I lived above sin. And I have a different way of looking at life so that I sin much less with the goal of being perfect. I may never be for more than a week or a day or an hour, I don't know, where I actually had no conflict with sin. But this is the only way to live perfect. Is it possible that you would be perfect living under the Old Testament law? Not in the flesh, but in the spirit and with the heart right and doing things Christ's way. Jesus, this is how you live perfect like your Father is in heaven. So this is dealing with our enemies. Now, Leviticus 19:18, it says, thou shalt not avenge, revenge, nor bear any grudge, that's a bad attitude, against the children of thy people, but thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself, I am the Lord. Where'd that other half come from, hate your enemy? It's not in the Bible. That was added. See, the Pharisees and the people were adding, well, I'll love my neighbor, but I will hate my enemy. And that's how it turned out. So they were inferring stuff. See, the people had taken this so far as to become totally racist as a nation. They hated the Babylonians, the Samaritans. They hated the Moabites. Did God call the Jews to hate the other nations? Yes or no? No, of course not. They were not to intermarry with them, but they weren't called to hate them. That's not their job. And yet, the Jews had forgotten that they were to be a light, that they were supposed to demonstrate what a relationship with God was. And instead, they took a superior attitude and they looked down upon and hated their enemies. Guess what? Our memory verse this last month was, for the gospel's sake, they are enemies for your sake. Concerning the gospel, they are enemies for your sakes. So they still look down on us. They still are enemies of us because they think that we'll only love our kind and we won't love Gentiles and we won't love especially those Christians generally. Now they have moderated, but Jesus turns it on his head, and he says that we are to love our enemies, which means showing love toward them, not seeking to be with them and enjoy their company and emulate them, but just be kind to them. So he's saying, look, you know, what do the Pharisees, the publicans do, and look at how they love one another. Shouldn't you do more? What do you more than others? And this is, this, Edward, is this going to be, even as a Christian, is this where I'm, now we're on here, let's see, what is it, verse 41, what verse are we on, did we start on? Verse 43, all right, on 43, our statement is, if I can find my page, hating enemies. That's what Jesus is dealing with in that section. And he says, what should I be more concerned with? What do you think, Edward?
I didn't get any question.
What is, when Jesus says, you guys are all caught up in loving your neighbor, which was the second commandment, but you hate your enemies. What does he replace it with? What does he say was more important than worrying about hating your enemies?
Is to love one another.
No, not just love one another. Love your enemies. Love those who you consider to be your enemy. So again, each one of these things is going further than I hate people who don't like me. I don't like people who don't like me. It's my nature. But Jesus says, no, bless them. Do good to them that use you. So chapter 5 is breathtaking. Let's turn to chapter 6 here. We got a few minutes. And as we pick up in verses 1 to 4, Jesus is talking about giving your money to good causes. So alms. Let's read about alms in verse 1. Take heed that ye do not your alms before men, to be seen of them. Otherwise ye have no reward of your Father which is in heaven. Therefore, when thou doest thine alms, do not sound a trumpet before thee as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, that they may have glory of men. Verily I say unto you, they have their reward. But when thou doest alms, let not thy left hand know what thy right hand doeth, that thine alms may be in secret. And thy Father, which seeth in secret himself, shall reward thee openly. Now almsgiving means giving to the poor. That's what alms mean. Almsgiving was. But let me tell you what the word alms means. In Old English, it means mercy, compassion. So you see somebody and they have no food and you're moved with compassion, so you give money to meet a need. So he's not just talking about, you know, I don't know, church giving. He's talking about personally meeting somebody else's needs. Almsgiving. What were they doing, Darren? What were they doing with their compassion giving in Jesus' day?
They were wanting to make sure that everybody knew that they were giving so that they would be praised by others.
Wow. Such a contradiction of you're trying to have mercy on somebody, but you're trying to get praise out of it. You're trying to get rewards of others out of it. Sounds kind of political to me. God's people are commanded to care about the needs of others. Over and over, Deuteronomy, Proverbs, over and over says, take care of the stranger. Take care of the poor. Minister to the person, even if they're a stranger. Do not mistreat a stranger just because they're not a Jew. Here, Jesus speaks as if it was going to be a natural part of the way of life in the kingdom. Are there going to be poor in the kingdom of God? Yes. And if they're not in the kingdom of God, at least those who are in the kingdom will deal with people who are poor. So it is a natural or a supernatural part of life now. It's a continuation of what God expects a good Bible-believing Jew to live by. It is part of personal righteousness. Now, Job 31, I'm not going to take the time, but Job 31, Job brags when he says, if I ever came across somebody who was in need, I always met the need. Now, he's angry. Job is frustrated at the fact that I've tried to do everything right, and yet I've lost everything. So that's why he's talking about, and he's bragging on his personal righteousness. He said, I met people's needs, and now my needs aren't being met. So he's feeling frustrated. But it is part of personal righteousness. Now, when Jesus talks of the synagogue, he's that was a place for the worship of God. And the Jews began meeting in synagogues several hundred years before the birth of Christ. And it simply means assembly. Like a church is a called out assembly of believers. But the synagogue was an assembly of Jews. Now, one would start, a synagogue would be started if at least 10 men decided to meet as a group to locally worship God. Now, the norm for the day was a great show of personal righteousness instead of just living righteously. So you see all the flamboyant giving in the temple there in Matthew 21. They're all coming in, and the ding and the ring of all of the coins and anything priceless going into the offering boxes in the temple was something to behold. People came and they watched giving, and Jesus went there with them, didn't he? Jesus came with the disciples, and he says, watch this. And they saw how people gave out of their abundance. He says, now watch this. And a widow woman came in two of the tiniest little coins you ever imagine, and she dropped them in and then hobbled off. Jesus said, that was awesome. And they went, that was the smallest amount. She said, yeah, but they gave out of their abundance. She gave all she had, and he praised her. So people would go and watch because it was such a flamboyant thing to do when they gave. That's how come I'm kind of, you know, I don't, listen, churches take up offerings and that's okay. I don't find fault with it. But I decided when we came to Ireland, and I liked how they did it up north, where you had an offering box at the back of the church. And nobody made a big show of it. People went up at different times, so there wasn't a long queue. And you weren't passing the plates and all this stuff. I just like it to be kind of secret. Kind of, don't worry about it. So, an hypocrite is an actor, a fraud. They're unreal. A hypocrite is what the Bible calls a reprobate. Somebody who's not real. Now, the teaching is clear. If you want your giving to count with God, count for rewards in heaven, then do it the right way. If you ever give to meet somebody else's needs, give so they don't even know who gave it to them. Don't ever give so that other people know about it. If people see you give and know how much you give, they will be impressed and they will honor you for a good deed. But that's going to be your payback. That's all the reward you will ever get. Don't announce your intentions and that you are making a great sacrifice. Jesus used an extreme illustration. Don't let your left hand know what your right hand is doing. Now, my left hand doesn't know anything. But he's given an illustration that they usually work together, don't they? But when it comes to giving, this arm is busy doing another thing, and this arm is quietly giving. That's his illustration. Give as secretly as possible, seeking no payback or honor from men, and the payback from God will be immense. And the idea is to trust God to repay you, not people's response to your actions. Isn't that precious? So when we get to chapter 6, verse 1, and we deal with giving, we'll say almsgiving here. What would you say, Darren, is his new focus? Here, in their day, it was very visible. What was Jesus telling them to focus on now? When you give, he's not saying how to give differently. Giving is giving. He was actually saying what?
To be a cheerful giver.
Say again there, Edward.
To be a cheerful giver.
Cheerful giver, you said?
No, not cheerful giver. Not yet. Paul says God loves a cheerful giver. But this is give secretly or invisibly. Invisibly, that's right. Give secretly. And that is amazing. Because all of a sudden, where is the focus now? The focus is on two people instead of one. Who are the two people that giving is? Here, what's the focus on? Let me start there. Me. Everybody watching me. Now he's going to talk in the next verse. We're not going to take the time to do it. But in the next verse, he says, when you pray, don't be like the Pharisees who say, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to pray. The focus is on you. And he says, when you fast, don't go around saying, I've been fasting for 6 hours. When you give, it's not about you. It's about others and about God. And you're just secretly meeting a need. And you know God sees it. That's it. And that was revolutionary to the Jews. And it's revolutionary, especially to us Westerners, who love the praise of men just as much as they did. All right. Any other questions or any thoughts? I never get the feelings anymore. Giving to the poor. Giving to the poor. All right. We'll make much more time next week. But you believe it's already November 1st?
Yeah.
2018 has flown and gone, come too fast. All right. So what do you think of this list? When you start to see, and we'll see it this next year, when you start to see how differently we live by, can you understand? When Peter says, you're a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a peculiar people. You are strangers in this world. You don't live by the same rules. Even the Old Testament was not the same as the rules of the world. But it's nothing compared to, because this is so much further and so much better, so much deeper. So, all right. Let's end it there. Okay.